From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Frances Alonso reporting. With nearly half of the votes counted, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's party is ahead in Sunday's snap parliamentary election after voters headed to the polls for the second time in 5 months. Voters say there's no doubt about the critical importance of the polls, with some in Istanbul voicing anxiety about increased civil conflict in the country depending on the results. June's elections were inconclusive, with no party able to form a single party government. The Somali militant group al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a deadly attack at a hotel in Mogadishu on Sunday, leaving at least 12 people dead, including the owner of the hotel, a military commander, and two lawmakers. Authorities say the militants set off a car bomb at the entrance of the Sahafi Hotel in Somalia's capital. Following the blast, gunmen stormed the hotel, which is popular with government officials and business executives. The Somali security minister told VOA that the attackers, all of whom were killed by security forces, were wearing Burundian military uniforms, but says they are still investigating to determine the exact identification. Meanwhile, the al-Shabaab spokesman, Sheikh Abdulaziz Abu Musab, has claimed responsibility for the attack in a statement on Sunday. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Sunday with Uzbekistan's President Islam Karimov. It's a rare high-level U.S. encounter with a ruler who is a frequent target of human rights criticism. The two held talks in Samarkand on the fringes of a diplomatic gathering of his five Central Asian counterparts aimed at reassuring them of Washington's continued engagement in the region, seen as exposed to militant Islam. VOA News. A Russian airliner that crashed in Egypt disintegrated in the air, according to an aviation official Sunday. It comes a day after the Metrojet flight disappeared from radar over the Sinai Peninsula with 224 people aboard. Nearly all of the passengers aboard the Metrojet charter flight were Russian tourists returning to St. Petersburg from the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. Two Ukrainians are also among the dead. Emergency crews have recovered at least 129 bodies, and both of the plane's black boxes, which record flight data and pilot communications. German Chancellor Angela Merkel failed Sunday to resolve differences within her ruling coalition on dealing with a crisis over a huge refugee influx, leaving open a row that has dented her conservatives' popularity. Germany, Europe's biggest economy and a long magnet for migrants, expects between 800,000 and 1 million asylum seekers to arrive this year, twice as many as any previous year. The Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister is denying a report that one of his colleagues said DRC elections slated for next year will have to be delayed for up to 4 years. For VOA, Nick Long reports.
Saturday, the Reuters news agency quoted ruling coalition spokesman Andre Alain Atundu as saying a national census would need to be carried out and voter rolls revised to ensure the credibility of a vote, so people need to allow 2 to 4 years for elections to be organised. But in a text message Sunday, Information Minister Lambert Mende told VOA the report is false. He suggested it had been circulated by pranksters on social media. A Reuters reporter told VOA he had been present with a number of other journalists when Atundu made the statement. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Democracy Sarah Sewell said last week during a visit to Goma that it is important to update voter rolls in Congo, but she suggested this was not a reason for delaying elections. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Romanians wept, cursed, and prayed Sunday as they mourned the victims of a fire in a nightclub, while doctors warned that the death toll could rise significantly because so many of the injured have severe burns. As the nation entered its second day of mourning, thousands paid their respects at the Collective Nightclub in Bucharest's 4th District. It's a scene of Friday's tragedy that so far has killed 29 people and left dozens badly burned. In a separate show of grief, thousands walked silently through the capital city of 3 million Sunday afternoon, carrying flowers and photographs of the dead. Over 140 people are still hospitalized around the Romanian capital. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on this show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. Iran has joined multilateral talks on the Syria war, a departure from the past when it was barred by Saudi Arabia and Syrian opposition groups. The invitation reflects both the recognition of Iran's key role as a major backer of the Syrian regime and the precedent set by successful negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. China has declared an end to a four-decade-old policy restricting couples to one child. The move, allowing two children per family, reflects concerns over a rapidly aging population and slowing economic growth. The U.S. House of Representatives has elected a new speaker and passed a budget deal that will lift the debt ceiling and stave off any threat of a government shutdown until after a new president and Congress take office in 2017. And finally, Republican presidential hopefuls participated in their third debate, this one featuring blistering attacks on each other and on the moderators, who pose probing and very personal questions. Tom, let's start with the Syria talks. For a very long time, a couple of years even, the Saudis, the Syrian opposition groups have basically said they would not participate in any talks that involved Iran. What changed?
Well, what changed is that the Russians decided to flex their muscles, I think, Barbara. And as we all know, the Russians have committed a pretty significant military force to Syria. They say it's to combat ISIS, but in fact, U.S. intelligence and Western intelligence says they're basically propping up Bashar al-Assad. So that, I think, has just fundamentally altered the calculation. And these talks, which have begun, basically give Russia a bigger seat at the table. And with Iran at the table as well, it means that Assad's future is settled for at least a while. I think what basically everybody in these talks has decided is we're going to set aside or kick down the road, however you want to describe it, the question of Assad's future. The Russians think he should stay. The Americans and some Western powers think he's got to go, that any arrangement for Syria in the future cannot include him. But for the moment, he seems to be as entrenched as ever, with the Russians being primary benefactors.
Tim, do you agree that it's all because of the Russian military intervention, or are there other factors involved?
Well, the Russian military intervention is clearly play that strengthened Putin's hand and allowed the current circumstance to go on. I mean, Assad is not going to be removed from power anytime soon. And this despite the fact that a 250,000 people have died in this ongoing conflict. But it's not just Putin that's overplayed his hand. It's also that the United States has declined to play the principal role here in ending these hostilities. Is that this administration has declined to use force when it said it would use force. It's declined to protect civilians when it says that a goal of its policy is to protect civilians. And, you know, it is Putin's strength that has led us to this point, but it's also American policy weakness.
Well, I would disagree with you a little bit there. I think that the U.S. didn't want to get involved militarily in another Middle Eastern war. And they've always said, the Obama administration has always said, that only a diplomatic solution is possible. At the same time, the U.S. is involved in bombing ISIS and in supporting an effort to contain ISIS and to roll them back. So I don't think it's fair to say that the U.S. is doing nothing. They are flying sorties and dropping bombs as we speak over
ISIS
positions in Syria.
It's not that they're doing nothing. It's that they're not doing anything to remove the Assad regime, and it's a stated policy goal that while he should go, they shouldn't do anything about it.
Is that still the stated policy goal? I mean, that's the question. Obama at the United Nations the other month said that what the U.S. is looking for now is a managed transition away from Assad, because I think the recognition is that you can't replace something with nothing. And right now, Tom, we have no viable alternative within the Syrian opposition who could step into Assad's shoes. These talks are partly about seeing if there is an alternative.
Right, that's right. If there were a handy alternative to Assad, I think his future would be problematic. But you're quite right, Barbara. There is none. And with the Russians de facto helping to prop him up, the U.S. has no leverage. We have a dog in this fight, but we don't have
a small one.
but we don't have a bulldog to take over Assad's place. So it's a jumble. It's a mess. And I think Secretary of State Kerry had it right the other day when he said our goal in these talks is to bring an end to living hell in Syria. But he didn't sound utterly optimistic.
Yeah. Tim, there's been another disturbing development, meanwhile, involving Iran, while their foreign minister is sitting at a long table in Vienna with all the other foreign ministers around the world. They've picked up another Iranian-American. Mm. I actually knew about this for more than a week, but the family had asked that journalists keep it quiet to see if they could get him out. His name's Siamak Namazi. Not a good sign for U.S.-Iran bilateral relations, is it?
No, and this is an individual, as I understand it, who is trying to promote ties between these two countries.
Very much so. It's always the one. It's always the do-gooders, right?
Yeah. Well, he went there for an idealistic reason. He was visiting.
Well, he went there to see his family.
Right, but in general, his principles are idealistic. They try to promote better ties between these two countries. He, dual citizen, he visited Tehran to see his family, and now he's become a pawn in a much larger game.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the Washington Post journalist who has been in prison in Iran longer than the 444 days that the American diplomats and soldiers were held hostage in the late 1970s by the mullahs. So it's pretty clear that the release of an Iranian-American was not part of the Iran nuclear deal, that's for sure, because...
Yeah. Well, no, it never was supposed to be. I mean, in all fairness, and I think one has to understand that the people who are picking up dual nationals in Iran are individuals who are opposed to the nuclear deal, who are opposed to any reconciliation between Iran and the West, and, you know, who are probably happy that now, you know, the headlines on the sort of blurb lines on TV where their reporters who are attending the Syria talks is Iran arrests another Iranian-American. That's exactly their purpose, unfortunately.
Right.
We're going to move on in a minute, but let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Tim Mack and Tom DeFrank. Tim, China has done something rather stunning for the first time in about 40 years. It has told couples that they can have two children, not just one. Why are they doing this?
Well, China's population is growing rapidly much older. And while it's not an immediate problem, these kinds of demographic issues and demographic laws, really autocratic laws, tend to take decades to take effect in the population. So if in 20 or 30 years you're going to start seeing a decline in the number of working age Chinese males and females, then you got to start addressing that now in order to prevent a decline in the working age Chinese population in the future. It really has been a tragedy over the last few decades that the government has been preventing couples from voluntarily having more than one child. I mean, it has been human tragedy on an untold scale that people haven't been able to have the kinds of families that they wanted to.
Well, you said authoritarian. I would call this totalitarian, actually, Tom. I mean, forced abortions, horrible stories, infanticide, particularly of girls, you know, girl babies being abandoned on the doorsteps of orphanages because families felt that if they could only have one child, it had to be a boy.
Right. It is certainly a blight on the Chinese books here. It's really indefensible from however you wish to calculate here. But clearly the Chinese are a little worried about economic growth. Clearly economic growth is dropped off. I mean, China is no longer this economic colossus whose economy is growing 6%, 7%, 8% a year. That's tapered. It's still strong. It's still growing. They're nowhere near a recession like the Russians are, but it's slowing. And I think bean counters and the numbers crunchers in Beijing are worried about that. And, I mean, Tim is right. This sort of thing takes decades to work its way out. But it just tells me, it should tell people they are worried about their economy, even though the changes may not be obvious. It's a blot on the whole Chinese system that they would do what they've done and allow only one child. Can you imagine what would happen in the United States if somebody running for president said, my policy will be this? Of course, it would be unenforceable in a democracy, but it speaks ill of the Chinese, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was in China, Tim, when this policy was introduced or shortly thereafter, and, you know, there was terrific fear that China at that time was such a poor country that if they couldn't control population growth, they would never be able to develop and become a middle-class country. Now the irony is that many people don't want to have more than one child because, you know, the women are educated and they've seen the financial benefits to a family of having only one child that you have to feed, clothe, and educate.
A different way of looking at it would have been that as China's economy developed, it would have naturally brought down the number of children that families had. And you see that all across the Western world, for example. You see birth rates dropping everywhere. But it is also true that China has become so crowded, especially in the urban areas where most people now live in China, that it's difficult to find housing space and it's difficult to raise more than one or two or, you know, a couple children.
Yeah. China's population, by the way, is 1.37 billion. And one-tenth of the population is age 65 or older. So, again, the concern is that there aren't going to be enough younger workers to support all of these old people. So we will see how this turns out. But I'm going to move a little more quickly than normally to our domestic news this week because there's a lot to talk about, Tom. Tim, I think I'll begin with you since you cover Capitol Hill. Congress. We were talking about a completely dysfunctional Congress, couldn't get anything done, threats of government shutdown, revolts in the Republican ranks against the leadership of the House of Representatives. Now, all of that seems to be tied together with a neat little bow. Yeah?
Well, I'm eternally pessimistic about these sorts of things. I mean, we have a new Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and he's liked by many people on both sides of the aisle, and we have a budget deal which passed this week, very late in the night on Thursday night. But I'm eternally pessimistic because I think the fundamentals of the situation are still weak. That the Republican Party in the House still has a faction that is willing to bring the House down if they don't get precisely what they want. That doesn't change because there's a popular speaker, and it doesn't change because there is a two-year budget deal, which should push some of the issues off the table for now, but doesn't return the House to normal functions.
Tom, do you agree with that? I was at a dinner recently with an unnamed member of Congress who's actually a member of the so-called Freedom Caucus, or Tea Party, and he was kind of grinning and saying, yeah, he said, we're going out like a lamb, he said, and he smiled. People talk about these Tea Party types as being, you know, willing to burn the House down and so on. But are they really? And especially now, going into, you know, in a presidential election season, you know, do they really want to make the Republicans look as the party that can't govern at all?
The Freedom Caucus, which is the conceit and the arrogance of describing themselves as the Freedom Caucus, somebody recently said to me, a Republican member of Congress, said they're not the Freedom Caucus, they're the Incompetence Caucus, and they will give us Hillary Clinton if they keep this up. Mm-hmm. I think they'd like to burn the House down if they could figure out a way not to get blamed for it, but I don't think that works. I think a large number of these so-called Freedom Caucusers would like to shut the government down, and their attitude seems to be, if that means the United States of America defaults on its sovereign debt, well, that's the price we have to pay. But that would be an economic cataclysm. The markets would tank, and they are rigid. They are hidebound. And I mean, the only thing that changes is the Republicans have changed a speaker, John Boehner, who was seen as not a symbol of massive resistance to the hated Obama administration, but somebody who was somehow an enabler to Obama and the Democrats, has been replaced with somebody that Republicans think is more of a real honest-to-goodness conservative Republican. We'll have to see. The numbers haven't changed. The Republicans don't have enough support to do everything they want to do without Democratic help. And so I don't think it's changed much. The most important thing is the kicking down the road of the debt limit. Debt limit has been taken care of till after the election.
After the election. But, Tim, it's more than kicking the can down the road. I mean, Speaker Boehner said he wanted to, quote-unquote, clean the barn before he left office at the end of October. And there is a deal here. I mean, it's actually similar in many ways to things they've been talking about for several years. They increased spending, I think, by about $80 billion, and then that's offset by some cuts in some programs. They're able to add to defense as well as to other kinds of discretionary spending. So it's actually a pretty good achievement, don't you think?
It's an interesting, and it all came together very quickly. I think what it does is it advantages the new speaker, Speaker Paul Ryan. He doesn't need to deal with this issue for 2 years, and we'll see what happens after that. So, yeah, I mean, it is a positive development in the sense that, you know, that there was a bipartisan achievement in the House and Senate, but it just kind of seemed to slip into the night.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it in a little bit more. Time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Tim Mack and Tom DeFrank. We were talking, Tom, about the budget deal. You know, Tim says it just sort of came together overnight, but a lot of these ideas had been discussed for a long time. So in a sense, you know, all of those efforts that were made in the past were not entirely wasted. Some of those efforts actually had been worked on by Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, I believe, of the Senate. They dusted them off and they rearranged them and put them into place, yeah?
It's a positive indicator, but I don't believe it's an indicator that peace has broken out on Capitol Hill. The Republicans still detest President Obama. I think going into an election campaign, and let's not forget, in 53 weeks, there will be a new president of the United States. I think more pragmatic Republicans were able to convince their, what I would call the howling at the moon Republicans, that you have to behave a little bit in the next 53 weeks or you will get Hillary Clinton or some other Democrat as the president, which would probably the Republicans would hate even more than they hate President Obama. So this is one way for Republicans to go home and say, see, we can make it work and still be true to our conservative principles. But I don't think spring is breaking out.
Yeah. One more point on this, Tim, before we move on, and that is my understanding is that they have set sort of the top limits for spending and so on. But that Congress still has to appropriate specific amounts for specific programs. So when they start doing that sort of work, of course, we could see more problems down the road, I would imagine.
Right. This is just a first step in a very long process. It clears the table for Speaker Ryan to get started, but it's by no means a finished product.
Okay. We're going to move now to the presidential race, Tom. Another debate. Jeb Bush, three strikes, he's out. He did not turn in a very high energy, to use Donald Trump's language, performance.
No, he was one of the clear losers in this debate, and he did not fare well against his somebody for whom he was once a mentor, Senator Marco Rubio, Florida, a former Speaker of the Florida House, and an ally of then Governor Jeb Bush. I think Rubio got the better of his one-time mentor. The real story was not who did well, but who did poorly, and it was clearly Jeb Bush. And you never want to be in a situation where the day after a debate you have to have a conference call with primary donors saying, no, I'm not dead in the water. And you never want to have a situation where the morning after reporters are asking you, is your campaign on life support? And I mean, and Jeb Bush is literally correct when he says, hey, we don't have an election for over 100 days, and it gets serious when people start winning or losing, and I've got enough money. Yeah. I mean, the Bush mantra has always been, we have more money, and because we have more money, we can lose some in the early going and still be fine, but not with debate performances like the other night. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Tim, Marco Rubio did very well. Ted Cruz also did very well, the two Cuban Americans, interestingly enough, in the race. What about the other, you know, so-called front runners, Donald Trump and Ben Carson? How did they do?
They seem to fade a little bit. If anyone's low energy, it's Ben Carson. He's very calm, almost to a fault.
It's kind of scary calm. It's almost
nothing seems to get him rattled or excited. His voice is at a very kind of monotone level and tone. It's strange. And Donald Trump seemed to be less enthusiastic in this debate than he was in previous debates.
The interesting thing to me, however, Tim and Barbara, is that after this debate, the numbers didn't change. Trump and Carson were still at the top of the heap. Hmm. Between them, they had somewhere like 56 or 57% mm-hmm. of all the support in Republicans, of Republican voters. And so I agree. I think Carson was not good. And you're right. He gives new meaning to the term phlegmatic. But their numbers did not change. And so that still tells me that Republicans are so sick of the establishment, or really anybody who has been in Washington, even Marco Rubio, who is a first-term mm-hmm. senator, that
who says he won't run again too.
he won't run again because under Florida law he had to choose, and he chose mm-hmm. he'd run for president. Mm-hmm. If he's not president or vice president in 2017, I think he'll be the governor of Florida and try again. But anyway, it was a bad night for Jeb Bush, and we've been saying, oh, this is the time for Bush to step up. Well, the next debate, he's out of second chances or third chances. This is one more performance like that, and I think he's going to be in serious trouble.
Tim, Ben Carson, yes, he's very calm, but he says some really amazing things. His grasp of economics seems a little thin. He insists that he's not homophobic, and yet he's against same-sex marriage. He said some very strange things about the Holocaust, that if Jews had had guns, they somehow would have been able to prevent their extermination. He doesn't seem to have a very firm grasp on history. And he also apparently has worked or has represented a dietary supplement company that claims its product can cure cancer and autism. Again, I'm trying to understand his appeal to the electorate.
Well, I think his appeal is that he hasn't served in government in any way. And we're talking, I mean, Tom was making a good point earlier about how sick people are of individuals who have spent time in elected government. And while some people might think that sort of experience is helpful if you're going to be president, the electorate does not feel that way at all. And Ben Carson, you know, during the debate, he simply denied, for example, he just denied things that were patently true, that he denied that he was ever a spokesperson for this supplement.
Yeah, he got $42,000 from them for his last speech
which is just verifiably, it's false for him to deny that. But his support and Donald Trump's support reflects how sick people are mm-hmm. of the same old people who have come through D.C. Mm-hmm.
Tom, the other thing that was striking about this debate was the way it was moderated by CNBC. And I have to say that some of the questions, frankly, appalled me. They were not substantive. They seemed completely directed at getting people angry and putting them on the spot. What was that about?
I would say, Barbara, quickly, about probably the only thing that Ari Fleischer and I agree with, and Ari Fleischer was George W. Bush's press secretary, is that Fleischer says the real bias in the media mm-hmm. is not ideological bias, but a bias towards conflict. The media wants to... Right. Beat up. It's called scuffling in the wheelhouse. Who's up? Who's down? Who screwed up? Who's in trouble? Who's going to drop out? And you saw a lot of these so-called gotcha questions. And yeah. I thought the ultimate in stupidity was when one of the moderators asked a question about fantasy football. Yeah. It's too hard to explain. It was so... Who cares?
And yeah. Ted Cruz, it gave Chris Christie of New Jersey his only good line of the night, though, as I recall.
Right, exactly right. That, you know, Rome is burning. It's the last days of Pompeii and Syria, and we're talking about fantasy football. And so I thought this was the worst moderated debate of all, And heads should roll at CNBC for that.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski, and our engineer was John Dryden. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Humankind has long been captivated by the planet Mars. Recent discoveries made by various probes, orbiters, and rovers that have been exploring the red planet over the past 50 years have made many of us quite excited about the possibility of someday sending humans to visit our neighbor in the solar system. The excitement about the exploration of Mars reached a high point recently when NASA scientists announced a remarkable discovery. This is Jim Green, the Director of Planetary Science at NASA.
Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
Today we talk about the past, present, and future of the exploration of Mars. We'll talk with guests from NASA here in Washington and at the Space Agency's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. We'll also be joined by the president of the Mars Society, a group that works to inform and educate people on the benefits of exploring Mars and creating a permanent human presence on the red planet. In our first segment, we look back at the exploration of Mars conducted in the past. We're joined by Eric Conway, who is an historian at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Eric, let's begin with the first successful NASA probe that was sent to Mars. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the first successful NASA mission was JPL's Mariner 4 spacecraft, which did its flyby of Mars in 1965.
And what about earlier missions? I understand the Soviets sent some probes out starting in 1960.
Yes, the Soviets tried very hard to be the first explorers of Mars. They sent a whole series of spacecraft out, and in fact, they managed to be the first to touch the surface of Mars. They had landers descend in 1971, but they actually failed before touchdown, with one exception that lived for a few seconds, sent back enough telemetry so that they knew it touched down and then failed. So the Soviets tried very hard, but they were not particularly successful.
Tell us a little bit about the first successful NASA probe, Mariner 4.
It was on a flyby trajectory of Mars, passed by in 1965. It carried a video camera, and it returned 21 images, grayscale, of course, in that era. It had the distinction of being the first digital data return spacecraft that NASA flew.
I understand Mariner 9 was an important mission. Can you tell us about this and why Mariner 9 was such an important milestone?
Mariner 9 was the first successful planetary orbiter, and it was designed to do a photographic mapping of the entire surface at a resolution kind of bigger than a football field. So it couldn't see small things, only large ones. And it also carried instrumentation for various other sorts of things, radio occultation for atmospheric science, and et cetera. And so its import, though, was really it was the first time a spacecraft carried a propulsion system to successfully go into orbit around another planet. Obviously, Lunar Orbiter had done the same thing for Earth's moon, so it was a follow-on to that kind of concept. It changed the way scientists saw Mars. Before, they had kind of seen Mars as lunar, with lots and lots of cratering, not a lot of valley systems. And Mariner 9 really changed all that. It showed what appeared clearly to be water-carved channels, again, the giant valley system. It demonstrated that Mars has enormous topographic relief, much greater than Earth appears to, is the discoverer of the giant volcanoes that we now call Olympus Mons,
After the Mariner missions, the Viking missions began, I believe, in the mid-70s. Now, what was the difference between the two missions, and what were some of the goals of Viking?
Viking project history is actually a little more complicated. It started with the name Voyager in, actually, the early 1960s. It's intended, actually, to be launched on a Saturn-class launch vehicle, the Saturn V. It got far too expensive and was ultimately canceled and replaced by the mission we now know as Viking to go on a smaller launch vehicle. And essentially, the goals of the Viking project, and here I have to give some credit to the rest of NASA, because NASA Langley Research Center was actually the leader of that effort. JPL built the orbiters and operated the orbiters and landers when they got to Mars. The goals of the project were to first orbit Mars, find safe landing places via orbital imaging, and drop a pair of robotic landers onto the surface safely.
Let's move into the 90s. What about some of the 90s orbiters? Tell us about one of the first ones.
Well, kind of the kickoff of the United States' return to Mars was supposed to be Mars Observer, which has become famous for vanishing 3 days before it was supposed to go into Mars orbit. It had several follow-on missions to recover its science. The first was Mars Global Surveyor, arrived in 1997, as I recall, and two more missions carried the rest of the Mars Observer instrumentations. The Mars Odyssey carried one instrument, the gamma ray spectrometer, and Mars Climbing Orbiter, and then finally the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter finished, ultimately, recovery of the Mars Observer science.
I understand that one or perhaps both of the Mars orbiters were credited with helping scientists find flowing water on Mars.
There's kind of a whole backstory to this. There have been previous announcements of the findings that there are kind of these gullies on Mars that have an albedo shift. In other words, their appearance changes over time. What this latest finding did was add the evidence from spectroscopy that there are hydrated minerals associated with that changing albedo shift, and that's the product of the CRISM instrument on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Let's talk a little bit about the rovers.
So the first successful planetary rover was the Little Sojourner rover on Mars Pathfinder. So the Mars Pathfinder lander's job was primarily atmospheric science. The rover's job was to sample the local area, again, with an alpha proton X-ray spectrometer for mineralogical purposes. And so its findings were to give an indication of the mineralogy of the Pathfinder landing site.
And, of course, the next step was the Mars Exploration Rover mission, which I believe were actually two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. And I understand between the Spirit and Opportunity, one is continuing its mission.
Yes, one has survived for more than, let's see, what year is this? It's on its 11th year on Mars. It's very impressive.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about historical look, a look back at exploration of Mars conducted by NASA over the years. I really appreciate it.
I hope it was interesting for you.
Let's take a short break. We'll be back with our next program segment after this.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today we're talking about Mars exploration in the past, present, and future. In this segment, we're going to talk about NASA's next Mars mission, the Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy and Heat Transport Mission, or InSight for short. Joining me to talk about it is Bruce Bannert. He's InSight's principal investigator and research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Bruce, could you please tell us about some of the goals and objectives of the InSight mission?
Well, we're going to be going to Mars to map out the deep interior of Mars, sort of provide a roadmap of what the inside of the planet is made of, all the way from the surface, all the way down to the very center of the planet in the middle of the core. And by understanding the structure of the planet, we hope to understand better how it was formed back in the first few tens of millions of years in the planet's history, so the first few ticks of the clock in the birth of the planet.
Can you tell us about the InSight spacecraft and its instruments and what their function is?
What we're really looking at is the global structure of the planet. And so basically anywhere we are on the planet, and you know, if you look straight down with our instruments, we'll see what we'll be what we need to see. You know, we'll be able to see the core, we'll be able to see the crust. And so we like to stay in one place and be very quiet. And that's because our instruments are essentially long-term listening instruments. The main instrument is a seismometer that measures the shaking of the planet whenever there's a Mars quake, similar to an earthquake on the Earth. And we use that shaking from the waves that have traveled through the planet from the Mars quake to our sensor to be able to use those waves as a kind of an X-ray probe of the inside of the planet. So as those waves move through the planet, they change their character based on the kinds of rocks that they pass through. And we scientists can then analyze the waves and sort of unravel that whole path and understand the composition of the planet that they've moved through. And in order to do that, we need everything else to be very quiet. So we don't want our spacecraft to be moving around. So in fact, we actually put the spacecraft to sleep for about 22 out of the 24 hours of the day so that it's extremely quiet and it doesn't disturb our seismometer.
Geologically speaking, can you give us a bit of a comparison between Mars and Earth and how they differ?
Well, Mars is about half the size of the Earth in terms of radius, and so it's a much smaller planet. Although, if you look at the amount of land area, we have about the same amount of land area on Earth as we do on Mars, since most of the Earth is actually covered with water. So, if you wanted to go and explore Mars on foot, you'd have about as hard a time as you would to explore the entire Earth on foot. Because it's small, it's actually less geologically active. Sort of the amount of energy that was stored inside the planet at formation, a lot of that energy has been able to sort of seep out and radiate to space over the life of the planet. And that's why we think that we can measure the character of the inside of the planet and still be able to use that to infer a lot of things about the birth of the planet, things that have been erased on the Earth by plate tectonics and vigorous mantle convection and volcanism and things like that.
As we know from the history of the Earth was basically shaped and formed over the years by such events such as tectonics and volcanism. Did Mars go through the same process?
We don't think that Mars ever experienced plate tectonics, or if it did, it was for a very, very short time early in its history. We don't know exactly why that's the case. We have some theories, and one of the things we want to do is test those theories by looking at the thickness of the Martian crust and the detailed composition of it to see whether it could have easily been initiated into plate tectonics. For example, some of the reasons why it might not have had plate tectonics is the crust may be actually too light and too buoyant to be able to be subducted back down into the Martian mantle the way the Earth's crust is subducted at the mid-ocean trenches on the Earth. And so there are a lot of geological questions like that that we think that we can answer by measuring the composition of the interior of Mars.
To draw attention to the InSight mission officials recently invited members of the general public to send their names to Mars. Can you tell us about this a bit, and what kind of response did you get?
Oh, we got a great response. So we collected names from people that wanted to send their names to Mars, and we had them all engraved on a microchip, which is going to be glued onto the outside of the lander and will actually be on Mars when we land. We put out that invitation, and we got many, many, I don't even know what the number is, but I think it was many hundreds of thousands of names from all over the world, not just the United States or the partner countries, but from Europe, Asia, Australia, South America, North America, all the different continents of the world. We got a huge response, and everybody who responded got a boarding pass, so everyone who has their name going to Mars has a boarding pass like you get to get on an airplane that shows that they're participating in our mission.
Bruce Bannert, thanks so much for joining us today and filling us in on the upcoming InSight mission to Mars.
It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Our topic is the exploration of Mars, past, present, and future. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA, or you can send us a good old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. My next guest on today's program is Robert Zubrin, who is the president and one of the founders of an advocacy group called the Mar Society, based in Lakewood, Colorado. As a part of its mission, the Mar Society works to inform and educate members of the public, as well as the media and government, on the benefits of exploring Mars and creating a permanent human presence on the Red Planet. Robert Zubrin, NASA scientists recently announced some rather significant news concerning the exploration of the planet Mars. They said that they found evidence of potentially life-holding water. Now, what are your thoughts on this finding, and what is its significance?
This discovery had been foreshadowed. We had some of this data in 2011, and even some people theorized based on observations in 2001 that this was going on. But what's new here is that it's been confirmed, and not just in one or two places, but as a widespread phenomena spanning the whole planet. So there's not just liquid water occasionally in one place on Mars. There's liquid water in lots of places on Mars and with some frequency. And so that means, yes, there could be extant life on Mars in a water table that these seeps are coming out of. There's plenty of microbial life in underground water on Earth. There could be so on Mars. And furthermore, we can get to it relatively easily because in our samples of this water containing some of these microbes, presumably if they're there, are coming out onto the surface. We don't even have to drill to reach it. Now, you might do better by drilling. You might get actual alive organisms. If they're on the surface, they're dead. Still, this is huge. And if there is life on Mars, that would prove there's life throughout the universe. It would prove that the development of life from chemistry, wherever you have appropriate physical and chemical conditions, is a lawful scientific process that occurs with high probability wherever such conditions exist. And since we now know there's planets everywhere, it means life's everywhere. And if there's life everywhere, it means intelligent life is plentiful, because the whole history of life on Earth is one of development from simpler forms to more complex forms, manifesting greater capacities for activity and intelligence and, in fact, ever more rapid evolution. So we go to Mars, we can find out if we're not alone.
What would you say to someone when they say, we don't understand why there has to be a concentration on sending people to Mars or even continuing space exploration? Why do you think it's important we go to Mars?
There's the science, there's the challenge, there's the future, and there is grappling with the issues that we face in the world today. Mars is the Rosetta Stone for letting us know the truth about the prevalence and diversity of life in the universe. It's something that people have wondered about for thousands of years. Mars can give us the answer. There's the challenge. Civilizations, like people, we grow and we challenge ourselves. And a humans to Mars program would be a tremendously productive challenge to every country participating. I mean, let's take one important example. We've got a crisis in education in this country. How about humans to Mars? How about saying to every kid in this country, as we did with Apollo, learn your science and you could be a pioneer and explorer of new worlds. Youth loves adventure. Let's make science the great adventure. You do that, you'll get millions of scientists. Okay, you get scientists by exciting kids about science and what they can do if they become a scientist or an engineer or an inventor. So that's what this would do. This would solve one of our most important problems in this country and the world, creating the intellectual capital to continue to advance society. Then there's the future. If we do what we can do in our time, we can create new branches of human civilization.
Dr. Zubrin, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
NASA recently released a detailed outline of its future Mars exploration plans in its report, NASA's Journey to Mars, Pioneering Next Steps in Space Exploration. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said that the space agency is closer to sending American astronauts to Mars than at any point in our history. Our final guest on today's program is Greg Williams. He is the Deputy Associate Administrator for NASA's Human Exploration and Operations Missions Directorate here in Washington, D.C. He tells us about NASA's plan for the future of Mars exploration, including what would be involved in sending humans to the Red Planet. Greg, why is it important that we send a human being to Mars?
There's nothing like having a human on the surface of the planet, actually more than one human. And the reasons are a couple-fold. One is, the human brain and the human eye are much faster processors than anything we have in terms of computing or sensing capability. And you can imagine just seeing a vista of the Grand Canyon in person is much more, I think, awe-inspiring. You can assimilate much more information. You really get a sense of what's there more than if you had a video camera recording it for you and then watching it at home on your television. The experience is vastly different. And decision-making also is a big factor. There's nothing like having a geologically trained person on site to decide which samples to collect, for example. Robots are good or getting better at manipulating objects and even doing primitive chemical analysis, but there's nothing like having a human scientist on the surface being able to choose one object over another for sample collection, or even to interpret in near real time what it is that he or she is looking at. It's a vastly different experience in terms of both the visceral human experience and also the scientific productivity of the endeavor.
NASA Administrator Charles Bolden recently laid out a detailed framework of a plan to put an American astronaut or American astronauts on Mars. Now, this plan will be implemented in three phases. Can you give us an idea of what needs to be done to fully implement this plan?
The three phases you're referring to, we describe them as Earth-reliant, as the proving ground, and as Earth-independent. What we'll need to be is be able to be Earth-independent one day, be able to operate, because the time delay of transmission of communications between the Earth and Mars can be significant, can be several minutes in length, and that's critical for operations. And so you want to start off in an Earth-reliant, which we're doing today with the International Space Station, and here's where we're actually learning to live and work in space for long periods of time. There's a lot to be done there, not only learning how to operate in microgravity environments, but being able to operate safely and to be able to sustain crew health and productivity over long periods of time. We're currently running what we call the one-year mission with astronauts Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko on orbit. They've just passed their halfway mark in that. We're going to learn a great deal about how to improve human health and productivity for long durations. We need to do that in an Earth-reliant frame where return times are measured in minutes to an hour if something were to happen and we prove out our operations there. Then we want to move from that Earth-reliant frame to what we call a proving ground phase. Here we're taking advantage of the fact that we have this large natural satellite, the Moon, to provide an environment to go to in which return times are measured in days to a week. And so there, you want to be able to practice the kind of deep space operations you would need to do at Mars or at an asteroid in its native orbit. And in that proving ground era, we call it the proving ground because you're really demonstrating that you have the capability to operate at long distances from the Earth. And we want to move from Earth-reliant through this proving ground phase to then an Earth-independent phase where you're in the vicinity of Mars or an asteroid in its native orbit where return times are measured in months or even a year or more. That takes this kind of progression to be able to achieve. And so we think we've got a program that's logically laid out to do that, and we think that stepwise approach makes sense in terms of advancing our technological capability but also practicing in an operational environment for long-duration human spaceflight.
You know, Greg, this sounds a lot like the steps that were taken to prepare humans to land on the Moon. Very reminiscent of that, including some of the side missions that need to be accomplished first. You had mentioned trips to Mars itself, perhaps in low Mars orbit, or perhaps orbiting one of the moons of Mars. What about the role of the ARM mission, the Asteroid Redirect Mission, and are there plans to really do some more exploration of the Moon before moving on to Mars?
We believe the Asteroid Redirect Mission is going to be really helpful in our long-term journey to Mars. It's important to put it in its proper context, which is that it is one of several missions that will take place in this proving ground phase. ARM is a mission to go out and robotically capture a near-Earth asteroid in its native orbit, redirect it into a stable orbit around the Moon, and then visit that object in the vicinity of the Moon with astronauts. In that latter phase, it's just one of several crewed missions to the cislunar space, to that proving ground, that will allow us to demonstrate things like deep space automated rendezvous and docking, again, extravehicular activity or spacewalks. We're going to send astronauts. They will dock with the Asteroid Redirect robotic mission. They will emerge from the Orion spacecraft in their extravehicular suits, encounter the asteroid. They will acquire samples from the asteroid and bring them back into Orion and bring them back to Earth. So you can imagine there are a lot of things that are going to be accomplished and demonstrated in that mission that we're going to need if we're going to operate in the vicinity of Mars, if we're going to encounter Mars moons, if we're going to have to do spacewalks in deep space. And then the other thing that ARM is going to give us is a in-space propulsion capability. We need to be able to move a spacecraft around in deep space, and that requires propulsion systems that are different inherently than the kind you use to get from Earth's surface to Earth orbit. And so ARM is going to use a new a high-powered solar electric propulsion capability, and we will demonstrate that capability first on ARM. We've used solar electric power before, but never at these high-power levels. We'll demonstrate this capability for ARM, and that will be the capability that we will use to move cargo masses from cislunar space to Mars, for example, to pre-position cargo for future human missions. So ARM is has an important role to play in the whole broader Journey to Mars strategy. With respect to the moon, we expect cislunar space to be not just a place to demonstrate that we can operate in deep space, but actually as a staging area in which we would send human crews and cargo to cislunar space.
Greg, can we explain what cislunar space is?
Yes, thank you. It's a new word for me, too, when I came to this job. Cislunar space is the volume of space around the moon. So it includes the moon, and it includes lunar orbit, but it's essentially the region of space that encompasses the moon. And the reason why that's important is that the laws of gravitation are such that with the Earth and the moon in their gravitational relationship, there are stable orbits around the moon that allow for low energy transfers from one location in space to another. And so it makes it a useful place in which to operate.
I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, if you don't mind, Greg, but what are some of the key challenges that still need to be resolved before we could move forward in sending humans to Mars?
There are several, and they're ones that we think we have a pathway on for pretty much all of them. We need to do some technology development work, but they include the in-space propulsion that I mentioned earlier. They include protection from the radiation environment. Deep space is outside of the Earth's magnetic field, and therefore crews in deep space are subject to cosmic rays that come in the natural background of the universe, and also the solar flares and so on from the sun. So there's radiation protection. There's finding the right balance between what you want to carry with you from Earth versus what you want to use in the environment you're going to. We refer to that latter as in situ resource utilization. In other words, learning to, for example, extract water and oxygen from the Martian surface and atmosphere to make your own water and oxygen, not only for human breathing and use, but also to make your own rocket fuel so you don't have to carry all the fuel for the return journey with you when you go. So in situ resource utilization is a big deal. Advanced spacesuits for EVA is a big deal. There are a whole list of those that we have detailed in the document that we put out. I hope you have access to. They include habitats not only in space but on the surface of Mars or one of Mars' moons, the ability to move around once you're on the surface, the ability to generate power, the ability to what we call entry, descent, and landing, to be able to land large masses on the Martian surface, but then not only do that but to be able to take off again. The Mars rovers, which were very, very successful, that technology, we're operating at the limits of that technology with respect to the entry, descent, and landing through the Martian atmosphere onto the surface. The Curiosity rover is about a metric ton. 1 to 2 metric tons is about the limit of that capability. We need to be able to land 5 or 8 or 15, or some people think even up to 25 or 27 metric tons on the surface. That's going to require different technologies, so we're working on that today as well. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the ascent off the Martian surface is going to require an ability to store, to manufacture, to be able to propellant load, and do all the things that you'd have to do to conduct a launch operation from another planetary body. So again, lots of challenges to overcome, but there are technology pathways that have been identified for each of those.
I got one final question for you, Greg, if you don't mind. Currently, at this point, what do you see, when do you see a human being stepping foot on Mars?
Wow, that's a good question, a hard one to predict. The goal we've been given is to be able to send humans to the vicinity of Mars in the 2030s, and so that means being able to go to the moons of Mars, to Mars orbit. To be able to get down, so that we wanted to be able to do that in the 2030s, to be able to put a human on the surface, that's really going to depend on what technology challenges we overcome, what international and commercial partnerships we entrain, and what funding is available, what economic conditions pertain in the 2020s and 2030s. Those things make it difficult to say, okay, we think we can put a human on the surface by X date. So we're going to bite it off one chunk at a time. We're going to have humans in cislunar space in the mid-2020s, and we're going to have humans at the vicinity of Mars, in Mars orbit and so on, in the mid-2030s. When we get to the surface is a factor. It depends on those three things I mentioned to you.
Greg Williams, thank you so much for taking time to give us an outline on the future plans of sending humans to Mars. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
And that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank the people who helped engineer this program, Eva Nanichka, Keith Holmes, Rob McLean, Linus Rimkus, and Dan Crafton. The science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Join us again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.